It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we're less than a week away from the general election. We'll get the latest election news from Harry Enten of 538.com.
First, a racist costume at the Badgers game in Madison this weekend has gotten national attention and led to outrage in the community. The controversial costume included a Barack Obama mask and a noose around the person's neck.
The noose costume led to several statements from UW-Madison administrators, including one in which campus officials said they asked the man to take off the noose and that the display was an expression of offensive but protected free speech.
Alex G. just wrote an open letter to UW-Madison about the institution's reaction to the costume. He joins us now to talk about it. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Alex G. is pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison and founder and CEO of Nehemiah. He's also the chair of the Justified Anger Coalition. Reverend G., welcome back to the show.
Hello, it's great to be here. Thank you for your invitation.
As we mentioned, this costume got national attention. What was your reaction when you first saw this news?
I was embarrassed for my campus. I was appalled by the thought that we're going to protect this person's right when we consider the seriousness of the sign or the symbol of a noose and what it means to Black Americans, what it means to our country, and to see it treated with just with such ease and what I call a slap on the wrist approach, I was fuming. And I'm also a dad of a UW Madison junior. I'm furious. I'm upset. I'm embarrassed. I'm disgusted. I could go on and on and on, but I'm feeling very strongly about this.
Talk about the symbolism of the noose. If people might think noose bad, but maybe not how bad a symbol that is.
Well, the noose historically was meant to really to curb insurrection. It wasn't widely used. Hanging and lynching was not widely used during slavery because the chattel property of the slaves were considered, they were valuable. But after slavery, as Blacks began to create HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, sororities, fraternities, churches, organizations, being elected to the Congress, the pushback during Jim Crow was to hang and to lynch African Americans, and men and women. If I may just be gruesome to the point of cutting open pregnant women's stomachs until their babies fell out, cutting off the genitalia of men and passing it around the crowd, burning people, dragging them through the streets, and then leaving them to hang on streets, on trees, in order to say to other innovative, sharp, brilliant Blacks, if you try to be too uppity, if you try to get your own business, if you try to vote, this is what you're going to get as well. And so to call that free speech is just to say a swastika or something else like that. It's just child's play. It's just guys playing. This is horrible, and it has evoked all kinds of emotions that we would expect the university to squash and to stand against. I think that they protected the wrong people Saturday night. I think the university protected the wrong people. And the thrust of my article was, you think this is free speech? It's more costly than you realize.
A lot of people do argue that even the most offensive speech, up to and including swastikas, it may be offensive, may be horrible, but we need to protect even things that are offensive and unpopular. You think that in a situation like a UW, a campus stadium, that there can be specific limitations on that kind of speech?
Oh, definitely. I think. Whoever makes those rules can be fickle. They can help to decide what's offensive because the noose means nothing to them, so they can say this is not offensive. But I was on a radio interview today with a young African-American man, Mr. Pickett, who was told that his shirts and his designs were offensive, and his Facebook account was shut down, and he didn't feel protected by the campus. And so I guess it depends on who's speaking, because it is not unilaterally accepted that what you say is protected by free speech, because certain people who look a certain way, who say certain things, don't necessarily get the same protection.
Talking to Reverend Alex G., pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison, talking about his open letter to UW-Madison officials about the costume involving a Barack Obama mask and a noose got national attention when worn at a Badger football game this weekend. You raised the concern of recruiting students of color after incidents like this get so much attention. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I'm a former UW undergraduate recruiter. I did that in the late 80s. And I remember after the incident of the blackface slave auction that took place on campus in 88, I remember students walking away from my booth in Chicago saying, oh, yeah, you're that school that had the slave auction. It's so easy to say that students of color from urban areas don't have the academic rigor to handle a campus like Madison. We don't really own the type of image that we let hang out there. And I'll be honest with you. My daughter's on an academic scholarship. She is a Nat Powers scholar. She's brilliant. She takes after her mom. I'm proud of her. But if my daughter came home at the end of the semester and said, Dad, I can't do this anymore. I need to go someplace else. Even though it means coming out of my pocket for tuition, I would support my daughter. So I'm not just talking about the recruitment of unnamed black kids in Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta. I'm talking about how I, as a dad of a current UW student, is thinking, did I really do best by my daughter by helping to encourage her to go to a school where her grandmother, her dad, her mom, her uncles, her cousins, all matriculated? And so I'm now questioning myself, have I set my daughter up for this type of psychological ramifications? Because I love the religious, I love the academic rigor of the campus, but I had no idea that what my daughter would face would far outweigh any racist insensitivity that my mom experienced in 1970 and 71. The city and the campus embraced her with open arms. I'm having to talk my daughter off the ledge at least once or twice a semester because of comments being made by students in her classes.
Yeah, you referenced the mock slave auction as one other bad spot in UW-Madison race history. This, you write in your piece that this incident at the game, this is not a one-off. This is not the first time.
No, it's not, because I mentioned a program that I was a part of on campus, the Academic Advancement Program. I remember when there were death threats against the staff and bomb threats against their facility. They actually moved out of their facility into South Hall. I remember when that happened. In my opinion, that program can never gain the initial sheen it had when it was recruiting students of color and getting them into this campus in great, great numbers. It dispirited the people. So when you show a noose or talk about threatening, folks tend to believe it, because in the past, when people say they're going to do something, they do it. It wasn't like a sign of someone just saying, you know, we don't like you, N-word, or we don't like, that's a little something different. The sign of a noose around the neck of a sitting president who happens to be black, what's that saying to the black students on the field and their parents who have traveled to watch them, you know, play? And to call this all free speech, and it's just we don't want to impede anyone's, you know what they want to say, what they want to do, then give us the names of the people the way they did Pickett when he made his shirt that talked about whites being racist. And let's give it fair, the fair treatment. But from my perspective, it is not fair. The rhetoric is old. We've had enough photo ops. There are enough smart people on that campus to figure out how do we turn this around. Because right now, there's a huge publicity problem, which is way more costly than coming down hard on that person who came in there and thought that they could do that in our stadium and have it become national news. I'm embarrassed.
A lot of reaction this week, in addition to the piece you wrote that we mentioned, 100 and over 150 African-American alumni wrote a petition to UW administration asking them to deal with this. I believe there's a community meeting going on, some contacts going on this afternoon. What are you looking for from UW-Madison? Who are you hoping takes leadership on this?
I'm hoping the chancellor and the Board of Regents take direction. And I'll be honest, I keep giving this analogy that when I go to get an x-ray, I don't expect the x-ray tech to give me a prognosis or to tell me how the treatment's going to happen. They identify an issue. One of the problems for me in Madison is that you open your mouth to say, ouch, this hurts or this is bad, that people want you to suggest what happens. We have built a national reputation, an international reputation of fixing issues, setting social policy, working with vitamin D. We have known by our Wisconsin idea The university can figure this out. I'm not going to start laying out bullet points for what they need to do, because the Holly Report said it in 87. The Madison Plan addressed it in 88. The groups of students who were called the Chicano Students Association, I believe it was, in the 70s, had a document. We've been telling people, we do a little bit, we can't find people, we can't recruit them, we can't keep them. The university knows what to do. The question is, are they going to hire the people, put the resources into doing this, making people accountable, not putting this only on the shoulders of people of color, but white leadership of the university taking ownership into this? Are they going to really own this as a collective problem so that they have a collective solution? Are they just going to keep pushing it to their black and brown special assistants to them to handle this? They've got to come off their perch and out of the ivory towers. They've got to connect with the community, and they've got to make change fast, because we don't have 20 or 30 years for them to get this together.
Are you optimistic that those things are going to happen, or are we going to be having this conversation again in 2, 5, whatever years?
You know what? I'll be honest today. I don't have that confidence. Today, maybe just because I'm frustrated, maybe it's because it's the aggregate amount of just frustration and the barrage of so much negative information. It's not because the campus doesn't know. It's not because the chancellor hasn't come to the community. It's not because we haven't said in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we need more people of color in key positions. We need curriculum to change. We need training of faculty and staff. They know what to do. So my issue is, if they know and if they want to do it, why have they not done it? And the only hope I have is not necessarily in their goodwill, but I'm hoping that national embarrassment will push them to do something that's different. But right now, I'm not banking on goodwill.
Reverend G, thanks for being with us again today.
Thank you.
That's Alex G, pastor at the Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison. He's the founder and CEO of Nehemiah and the chair of the Justified Anger Coalition. Turns to talk about his open letter to UW-Madison officials about the institution's response to a costume with a Barack Obama mask and a noose at the Badgers game over the weekend. You can find a link to his piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll get the latest in national politics with Harry Enten from 538. We'll get to that in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll try to get a handle on why the most important email in our inbox is the one we're least likely to get around to answering.
First, in less than a week, voters across the country will head to the polls to cast their ballots for president, as well as for candidates vying for state and local seats.
With only 6 days left to go, we're taking a look at the most recent polls and late-breaking news.
Joining us now, as he does every week, to talk national politics is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
All right, 6 days to go, which you've noted. You're counting it down. Where are we in the polls?
You know, it really does depend which polls you look at, but in the aggregate of polls, I think the message is pretty clear. That is, Hillary Clinton holds a lead in this race. That lead is smaller than it was at the beginning of the last month, October, after she was coming off the first debate. But nationally, she's probably ahead by around 4 percentage points, and she leads, although perhaps slim, in some of the states, in the necessary states to get to 270 electoral votes. But the race isn't over, at least not yet.
Well, 4 points ahead aggregate, as you said, is getting kind of close to the margin of error in a lot of those polls. What do you make of that?
Well, certainly. You know, if you look back, for instance, in the 2000 election and you looked at the national polls before that, George W. Bush held a lead of about 3 percentage points on average. Obviously, Al Gore won that popular vote barely, and then Bush snuck by in the Electoral College. Possible. We could have a polling error that, you know, could throw things. But if you just look across the different states, you see Clinton really does, at least at this point, seem to have the leads that are necessary. Whether you look at Pennsylvania, or you look at Wisconsin, or you look at Colorado, or you look at Virginia, she has the lead in the states that she needs. But again, it's possible that those polls are wrong. It's just not likely.
And this afternoon, we just saw the release of the Marquette Law School poll, and it looks, we were talking yesterday on the show, is Wisconsin getting a little more swingy? Is it more of a swing state? And that one is looking pretty solid in the Clinton camp. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin's been one of those states that I know Donald Trump has wanted to play in. It's a state Republicans have been wanting to play in for, you know, the past 20 years. But the fact is that when you look and you see the Marquette poll that has Hillary Clinton leading by 6 percentage points in that state, if Donald Trump can't win in Wisconsin, then he has to go to a state like Pennsylvania and win there. None of the polls have him up there. And then all of a sudden you're basically going to these small little states like New Hampshire, you know, and you're basically just trying to find any path. And the fact is that Hillary Clinton's best polls in these states have her up by 5-plus percentage points, and Donald Trump's best polls in those states maybe have him up by a point or two. And at the end of the day, when you average them all out, Hillary Clinton just has a much clearer map. Thanks in large part, this Marquette poll that came out this afternoon really makes it clear that Trump's map is limited.
And early voting is underway in a lot of states, you know, including Wisconsin. Are you seeing anything interesting there so far?
Well, you know, early voting is something that I'm very cautious to read too much into, because the fact of the matter is that a vote cast on Election Day is worth the same amount as a vote cast early. And most states, we don't really have good trend lines to understand, you know, what does it mean when one party is up in early voting versus the other. There are a number of states where we don't even have party registration, so we can't actually know who's coming out to vote or not. We do know, in the aggregate, Hillary Clinton is leading in the early vote. The votes that have been cast so far, she's doing better than she'll probably do on Election Day. But with perhaps the exception being the state of Nevada, I would not read too much into the early vote numbers so far.
We're talking with Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, getting a check-in 6 days before Election Day on the latest in the race for president. And we'll look at some other key Senate races in a bit. But first, Harry, news broke last Friday that the FBI would take steps to investigate emails related to Hillary Clinton's server scandal. We thought, the Clinton camp at least thought, that that chapter was closed. It was late in the game. Does that fit the standard kind of October, I guess, November surprise in this case, almost November?
Sure. I mean, look, an October surprise is basically what you call an October surprise. But certainly it was a late-breaking, developing news story. It doesn't seem as if Hillary Clinton lost any votes from Democrats because of it. It does seem that Donald Trump perhaps gained some votes from Republicans who might have been saying they were undecided or voting for Gary Johnson. But I should point out that any tightening that we've seen in the polls post this Friday announcement was already occurring beforehand. We had already seen that the race was somewhat tightening in the middle of last week, and this is perhaps a continuation of that trend. But at the end of the day, what Donald Trump needs to do isn't just gain votes. He needs to take some away from Hillary Clinton. And while perhaps he's done that somewhat, he hasn't done it anywhere near enough in order to for this race to be called truly a toss-up.
So you don't think the tightening that has been reported on, you know, with some ambivalence there, but you don't think the tightening in the polls is related to this email announcement?
Some of it is. Most of it probably isn't. I mean, you know, if you can look at our odds last week, we had already had Hillary Clinton trending downward. There were some questions about a tightening race then. If you look, for instance, at the Marquette poll, perhaps there's a little more evidence that the Comey news, you know, maybe had an impact. But across all of the polls, for instance, if you look at the Monmouth poll from Pennsylvania today, Patrick Murray, who's the pollster there, basically says exactly what I'm saying right now, is that the race was tightening before the reveal that they're going to be looking at Anthony Weiner's computer. So, sure, it's a little bit related, but it's part of a larger trend of Trump picking up Republicans and therefore seeing his polling climb.
Well, let's look at the electoral map right now for a moment. Looking at Clinton's road, what does she need to take?
Well, essentially, Wisconsin is one of those states that she needs to take. She then needs to take Pennsylvania and Michigan, as well as Virginia and Colorado and New Mexico. And then she basically just needs to win one other state among Nevada, North Carolina, Florida, or New Hampshire, and then she can get to 270. And she is leading in at least a few of those states right now, even if they're small leads. So she really just needs to pick one of those, and that seems fairly easy for her. Versus Donald Trump, it's a much longer road to haul because he needs to win in states where he's either tied or clearly behind in the polls right now.
And so play that out. What would that look like if Trump is the one who emerges the victor?
He would need to win in the certainly in Florida. He'd need to hold Ohio, which he probably will, Iowa, North Carolina, and then he'd need to go into either Colorado, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or New Hampshire. And while there's a potential that he could go into one of those and win, it just doesn't seem like he's going to be able to you know, if you look at the polling in Florida, for instance, while there's some polls that have him up and it's a must-win state for him, there are plenty that have him down there in the same news in North Carolina, and these are must-win states for him. So it's plausible that he can, you know, basically turn the table, but it's very difficult.
Are there any long-shot scenarios that you're looking at 538.com on election night, you know, something like a tie?
Sure. I mean, you could get a tie. That's plausible. You know, you need the exact states to fall where they are in Maine, which obviously breaks up its electoral votes by congressional districts. So each one of the congressional districts gets one. Those have to go the right way. So it's plausible that we get a tie. I think, though, the two scenarios that fascinate me most are basically no one gets the 270 electoral votes because in Utah they vote for Evan McMullen, the independent third-party candidate, or where we end up in a situation where Alaska, which has traditionally been a Republican state, but there have been a number of polls conducted there that suggest a close race there this year, and the polls haven't always been that reliable, where the race comes down to Alaska, and somehow we're waiting on ballots coming in from Native American, American Indian territories in the northern part of that state, and we're basically waiting for days to try and figure out who'd win Alaska. Probably not going to happen, but you know what? This is fantasy land. Why not play it out?
Might as well think about it. You're prepared, I suppose. And Harry, the presidential race, not the only race happening. What else are you watching?
Obviously, we're watching the Senate. We have Democrats somewhat favored to win that back, but as I think the Marquette poll showed, you know, Ron Johnson coming up very strong on Russ Feingold, and that's a state that I think a lot of us had in the Democratic column. Then you look at a state like Pennsylvania, which we thought was going to be a toss-up between Pat Toomey, the incumbent Republican senator, and Katie McGinty, the Democratic challenger. And McGinty has been leading in pretty much all of the latest polls. So you've seen this flip, and no one seems to be getting an upper edge. So it's going to be very interesting to see if whether Democrats can net those four seats that they need if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency in order to take control of the Senate. And it's not clear either way at this point.
Harry, we had an interesting thought as we were getting ready for the show today. By this time next week, more or less likely, we're going to know who the next president is. Is it kind of mind-bending to think about it's going to be over? What are you doing to prepare for the end of election season?
Well, I'm preparing my sleep schedule. You know, I'm hoping to get more than 5 hours of sleep afterward, and I'm also preparing for my yearly Columbia Lions football game that I go to. Columbia, one of the worst football teams in the nation, and I didn't even go to Columbia, but I'm looking forward to that and watching it with around three other people. Instead of the team meeting us as a group, they're going to come up to the stands and meet the fans individually.
Well, Harry, we'll look forward to a whole new conversation with you next week. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He was with us to talk about the latest in the race for the White House. Election day, of course, next Tuesday, November 8th.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the new rules of etiquette for a digital age. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about the Trump campaign after the KKK embraced Donald Trump in its official newspaper.
First, there's no solid rule book for etiquette when it comes to how we communicate in the digital age. But one emerging guideline seems to be answers should be given in the medium the original communicator has selected. That's according to Slate.com. In other words, if somebody sends you an email, you answer with an email. You don't call or text.
It can be a confusing and murky time that's causing some head scratching. One other lingering question, why is the email that's the most important to us often the one that we never get around to answering?
Amy Alcon is here to help us sort it out. She's a science help author, a speaker and podcaster, and she's the author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I love this topic.
It is. Well, yeah. And are there any general rules of etiquette that we've somehow all managed to agree on when we communicate in the digital age?
Actually, probably not. And but the Slate columnist is wrong. You know, yeah. The thing that you have to do is find out what people's preferences are and go with them, because some people prefer to get a phone call. Some people prefer to get an email. And so the thing is, especially for people under 40, the phone call has become rude, largely. I mean, that's not if your doctor's office is calling you to tell you if you have a brain tumor, but, you know, in a lot of cases. And so that's something to consider.
Right. That's so interesting, that thing about phone calls becoming rude. I have kind of intuited that, and just based on also how I feel if I get a phone call, when I think to myself, crambling, but I emailed you, why are you calling me? You know, so but it used to be a mark of courtesy. You called people. What do you think is going on?
Well, calls are special if it's your friend from Paris and you haven't talked to them for a long time. But we all have all these methods of communicating that allow people to get to your communication when it's convenient for them, as opposed to, you know, basically it's like walking into somebody's office, shoving everything off their desk and say, you listen to me right now, you hear? You know, to call somebody when you can contact them in all these other ways.
Yeah, people have been retroactively looking at the etiquette of the, you know, the landline phone era. When you make a noise happen in somebody's house, not caring what they're doing, sleeping, eating, whatever in the meantime, with the expectation that they're going to drop everything and talk to you then. Were we, without thinking about it, really rude in the era of just phone calls?
Well, no, because we had a lot more etiquette about when you call people. You didn't call people in the middle of the night, you know. And now, you know, people, actually, this is a big problem with work email. People's bosses email them in all hours. And work is so competitive in many areas that people feel compelled to be checking their email at 9 p.m. when they should be having a life. So that's something that I advise, that you email people you do business with during business hours. And if you're a boss, you create the moratorium. You don't have this just be not spoken, because then everybody will do that. They'll email you at 7:30 or 11:30. And then what, you're supposed to wake up and answer that email like as if there's a fire?
No, that's interesting. That's one that I struggle with, because I'm a night owl. And sometimes it's when I get stuff done is at night. And even especially with texting, I guess, because that is something that if someone hasn't turned off the sound, their phone could ding and could wake them up. But on the other hand, I'm thinking of it then. And if I don't act then, you know, it might not ever get done. So do you think we should not also text, for instance, after a certain hour?
Right. Well, people need to be proactive. And what I do at night is I put my phone on airplane mode. So if you're having a heart attack, you should probably text somebody else. But I tell people this. And actually, the thing to do, this is the thing that I do because I'm very impatient and a needy client to my literary agent. And I want to email her immediately and get an answer immediately. But instead, I write the email and I send it to myself. And I write a time in the little subject line. And you can do that with text to send later, because you know you're going to wake people up. I realized that after people started waking me up in the middle of the night with text, like, sup. Like, sup, I'm sleeping.
Well, one big etiquette question out there is, how soon are we obliged to respond to the text or the email? And I'm on both sides of this. People bug me, hey, Rob, why didn't you get back to me sooner? And I'm like, well, I've got lots of emails. It takes time. On the other hand, as somebody who sometimes, you know, produces radio segments, I'm expecting people to get back to me as soon as humanly possible, so I know what's happening on the show tomorrow. So what are there rules of thumb on response time?
Well, we know that those emails like yours, you know, that they are very time sensitive. So it helps to write time sensitive on them for anyone who's kind of dumb. You know, they don't think that you're going to be on the Pony Express version of the radio, you know. And so, but the thing is, what I say is that technology makes a nearly instant response possible. It doesn't mandate it. But then on the other hand, you know, people, they get their feelings hurt, or, you know, they're waiting for some response, especially if it's creative work. So what I think is important to do is, when you can't respond promptly, say so. Tell them, look, I'm so overwhelmed. So they know it's not them, and you don't hate them and think nothing of them. Swamped will respond as soon as humanly possible. Just an answer like that, that acknowledges them and makes them feel that you haven't violated their dignity, which is basically our feeling that other people value us.
We're talking with Amy Alcon right now. She's a Science Hub author, speaker, and podcaster, and she's with us to give us some advice, etiquette lessons for the digital age. And I want to talk about those important emails that we get. Maybe it's that message from a friend who we haven't connected with in a long time, and they actually sit down to write you something resembling a letter. but you can't just write, cool, thanks, and send it back. You want to reply thoughtfully. And at least this happens to me. Sometimes I never reply, or it's months before I reply. And that's the most important thing in my inbox. What's going on there?
Well, we feel so guilty about being human and fallible that we just let that throw us. The thing is, we're all really busy. We get 2 tons of email. So I would, with someone like that, say, oh, what a wonderful letter. I can't wait to write back to you. I'm a little bit swamped, to do that thing. But also to realize to not turn yourself into a criminal. When you've done that, I actually just wrote to the LA Times Festival of Books ladies, who are so great to me. I wrote them a thank you note 6 months after the book festival, because I just turned in a book to my publisher. Everything was devoted to that. And I told them that. So you tell people the reason why. And I think the subject line was, this is probably like the latest thank you note ever, or something like that, because people want to get a response. And so, you know, they'll feel better once they get it, especially if you give them a reason. If you give them a reason, that sort of lets them off the hook emotionally from thinking that you think that they're a crumb.
Yeah, in the age of email and all the other stuff, I mean, used to be when you hand wrote a person a letter, that was kind of a big deal, right? It was a really special thing. Can email or any form of digital communication really match that these days?
I think it really is that old, it's the thought that counts. People can tell if you put a lot of thought into email, but by the same token, the truth is people don't want really long emails, and I am so guilty of this, you know, the Tolstoy length email. And so really shorter is better, but I have to say getting something in the mail is so special now, and I really recommend that for parties, that people, if you go to a party and somebody did more than put out a plate of tortilla chips, or a bowl, I guess, of tortilla chips, you should send them a thank you note. But this doesn't have to be some like big deal that you write on some expensive stationery. I get postcards, vintage postcards from eBay. The great thing about those, really small space to write stuff. Thanks. Great people, great party. Love you.
Nice.
You know, and you're done.
We're talking with Amy Elkin right now. She's with us to help us sort out issues of etiquette in the digital age. She's a Science Help author, speaker, and podcaster, and the author of the book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you have an etiquette question or complaint in the world of email or texting or phone calling? Do you still call people up to talk apart from call-in radio shows, or is it inconsiderate? Do you find it a nuisance when people just call you out of the blue and expect you to talk to them? Call in now at 800-642-1234. We won't be annoyed or offended. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrin.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Amy Elkin is with us right now to look at questions of etiquette in the digital age. She's a Science Help author, speaker, and podcaster. Her book is called Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it comes to digital communication, the phones, the texting, the social media posts, do you have an etiquette question, or, as I almost coined there, an etiquestion? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Joe is with us in Marinette. Joe, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hey, thanks. I tend to operate in the Eastern time zone. Boy, you get a lot done early in the morning before other people get up and so forth. But people do travel, and especially Europe to California to Hawaii. There's almost 12 hours difference there. And so sometimes getting messages, people are not always at home, so that should not be looked at with disdain, but it's people are just taking advantage of where they're at and so forth. The other thing is that at work, yeah, work is one thing, but people have other responsibilities that may be work-related, and they're trying to do those things in the evening, and it is good to get something off your plate and get it on to somebody else. And sometimes I do appreciate answers, even if they come in late at night, because I know that in the morning then I can execute my other responsibilities. And finally, the etiquette of which media to respond in, I hate it when sometimes you have to call somebody, because email or text is good if it's just yes, no, or giving information. But if you have to discuss something, at some point I'm just going to call this person. And finally, it bugs me though when people email me and say, please call me. if that's important, then just you call me.
Uh-huh. Got it, Joe. Thanks a lot. A lot there to chew on. Joe's been thinking about this stuff. The time zone issue, Amy, a lot of people for work or personal reasons are working across time zones. Is it basic etiquette just to make sure that the time you're calling in is a reasonable hour to contact someone else?
Yeah, you really need to figure that out. And again, you need to ask people what they prefer, you know, or you can, some people you'll just know, you know, I don't, my litter agent, I was, you know, I send her things if it's an emergency at night, like I send her my book to send in the middle of the night on Sunday night, so she'd have it first thing New York time. But she's also a mom and has a family. And so I never send her things on the weekend. And she told me I'm the only one of her clients when she went on maternity leave who did not contact her. And believe
wow.
me, I am a needy person. And I wanted to, but I pretended, I thought she needs this time off. She's a right to this time off. So I pretended that she was in Greenland and had no access to email.
Oh, that's thoughtful. Well, Joe, thank you so much for asking those questions. We're going to go next to Scott joining us in Whitewater. Scott, hi.
Hi. I don't think that texting is always a fair form of communication. My wife, now ex-wife, one of the most frustrating things was when I'd get home and she'd ask me if I did all the things she asked me to do. She goes, well, did you look at your text messages?
Right.
Like
that's,
sometimes, uh-huh. you know, you got the radio turned up or
understandable.
You know, you don't get your text messages. And it's like, why don't you just call?
Scott, that's a really great point. I think that happens a lot. There's the assumption now, Amy, that you have a phone, you can be checking your text so that you should be up to the minute on things or plans. And, you know, I think I've been, like Scott, I've been on both sides of that, actually, where I've been annoyed at someone or had people annoyed at me because, hey, because I may not have checked my text before. I'm sure that was an incidental sound by you, Ron.
Sorry, I had to clear my throat.
Amy, what about that? Is it reasonable to expect someone to check their texts?
No, because people are very, very busy. Now, if all they do all afternoon is sit by the seashore, you know, and they're really just thinking a few thoughts, reading a novel, you know, maybe you could expect them to look at their phone. But, you know, the description, like being in the car and all busy and everything like that, that's human to not check your email. And the same thing also goes for people who don't respond to an email. Our first line of you know, our first thought is to think they hate me, they're treating me terribly and everything like that. And you know what? A lot of times they're maybe busy and got a slew of emails, or they didn't see your email, or they meant to respond to it and they forgot. And so what I like to do, instead of hating them, I just send the email back and say, maybe you missed this. So assuming that they are a good person who's busy rather than a person who thinks nothing of you and doesn't think that they're ever going to respond to your email.
Do you think that works, though? Isn't that a little I've thought of doing that, but it seems transparent.
A little pushy,
it seems like I'm obviously saying, hey, get back to me already.
Well, no, but it is a thing, you know, when you wait and you haven't gotten something within a reasonable amount of time. So if you're sending something that is not like, I need a response in 35 seconds, you know, like, are you going to talk about this on the radio or something like that? Then it's reasonable, like you wait a day or two. And if the person hasn't gotten back to you, you send them something again. To give you an example of this, there's a psychiatrist who I really respect who does evolutionary medicine, and I wanted her to help me on a question and, you know, be quoted and everything. And so I emailed her. I didn't hear from her. Well, first of all, she didn't get the email. I sent something to her in a direct message. Didn't get that, so I resent it. And then I heard back from her, and something is going on in her life, and so she told me, oh, I can't deal with this now. Mm-hmm. So there's this communication, and it wasn't me thinking, she hates me, she thinks this is stupid, you know. It was just,
right.
You should first assume that the person doesn't hate you, doesn't think it's stupid, didn't mean to forget your email or lose it, or it's in their spam folder along with all those people from Nigeria who want us to send them $3,000, you know, and write them back. And just I don't feel it's transparent in any bad way when I send that. Maybe you missed this, because I'm not sending it angrily. And I have to say, I would have sent it angrily before I wrote this book, but I gave it a lot of thought and I realized, oh God, a lot of times we just miss it because life is busy now.
He said ex-wife, our caller, so maybe it's a little late for relationship advice,
right.
But maybe for a couple or people in a work environment, even set ground rules. Say, if you want me to get something on the way home from work, do it by 4:30 when I'm getting ready to leave. I will check before I get in the car. Like, establishing ground rules could make a lot of difference for people.
Great example. So my boyfriend's been feeding me for a year while I've been sitting here at my computer, and he says, get your grocery list in early because he's going to the grocery store. So that's the considerate thing. He's told me he needs it at a certain time, you know, and just to give you one more example, I write a science-based love advice column, and I got a letter from a woman who, it was actually an email because no one sends letters anymore, except if they're in jail. She said, you know, she wanted her boyfriend to text her back. You know, he'd be at work and he was all busy. And so what happens with something like that is you meet in the middle. So she just wants to be acknowledged and he has a job to do. So what he does now is he sometimes texts her back, and he texts her when he's not at work voluntarily without responding to something, just, hey, babe, love you, or whatever it is. So she knows that she is in his thoughts. This is actually called it's called the dependency paradox. It's by a researcher, Brooke C. Feeney, who found that when people who are needy, if you just reach out to them, don't make them chase you, that they become more independent and less needy.
Oh, interesting. It could be a whole other segment with you where we talk about love advice in the digital age.
I love that.
Let's get another caller in. We've got Shane with us in Beloit. Hi, Shane.
Hi there. So I wanted to ask, what's a good way to, like, really convey sarcasm in email or text? Because the way I may write something may not be how you read it. There may be two completely different sort of perspectives on it. And it can cause a lot of confusion and maybe frustration. So it'd be nice to sort of eliminate that if possible.
I see. Amy?
I've got an answer for you. And the best way is actually, in brackets, sarcasm alert, as in those two words.
Ah. Okay, not an emoji. I thought you were going to go for an emoji there.
Oh, no. I'm too old for emojis, except the poop emoji, which just charms me.
Shane, what about that? Could you see yourself doing that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, sarcasm alert.
I have kind of the opposite problem when I send emails and I read it back. If I've done periods at the end of every sentence, it looks terse or rude or dry. And so I add exclamation points. Thanks! Exclamation point,
yeah.
Which isn't really fitting my normal everyday personality. Also, because if people know me, they'll think I'm being sarcastic. So I feel like I need those exclamation points to cheer it up a little. Is that okay?
I don't know. You come off as pretty snippy, I think, in digital communications.
I mean, yeah.
I think that we just don't think about stuff like this. You know, we just do it. We do this thing and we get this knee-jerk response. And the more you do something, the more it becomes this behavior that's worn in neurally. And so you actually have to back up and think about it. That's the thing that we need to do with all sorts of things on the internet. Privacy, who you'll be, like how nice you'll be, how you'll treat other people, and also what you'll do when other people are rude to you. And the thing about email, you can just take 5 minutes and think about your email style. I do this exclamation point thing too, and I realize it makes me sound like I'm eight, and so I try not to do it so much. You won't understand this as a guy, but as a girl, you accessorize, you know, you put on your earrings and your hair thing and your scarf, and then you have to like take off two things. So it's the same kind of thing with an email. You take out two exclamation points.
Huh. That's an interesting one.
I only do one. I don't do like the triple exclamation
point. Rob's pretty heavily accessorized. I don't know. Well, maybe not.
Well, Elmore Leonard, the crime writer, he said you get one exclamation point per book.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. This is reframing everything for me to go easy on the exclamation marks.
Email's different.
Right. Well, Amy, I want to ask you about something we haven't touched on really yet is RSVPing in the digital age, because I find... And I'm interested to hear your take, that people seem to be a little more lax when you invite them through a digital form. Maybe it's a Facebook invite. Maybe it's an email with a whole bunch of people. Some people, they seem to think, well, this is an email. I don't need to RSVP, even though it says RSVP. Is that loosening up the whole practice of RSVPing?
It's terrible. It is such a huge pet peeve of mine. And so many people are so lax about this. I RSVP right away, right when I get an invitation, even to say maybe, because those electronic annoying ones have the maybe thing, because I know that the person will get no responses or maybe one response and feel terrible. So I want them to get at least my response. And so, yeah, this is a huge problem.
Is it okay in an invite to say, and maybe this is more of a casual way to approach it, hey, let me know if you're coming. I need to know how much food to buy or something like that to say, here's, it's not just, I'm just trying to get a ballpark figure. Like, I really want to know how many people are coming
or
for planning reasons.
Does it sound a little snippy again?
Well, if it's coming from me, yes.
It does sound a little snippy. But actually, the problem is a digital thing. So we respond to other humans. This is like people being rude on the road. We're in our auto bubble. We're in the digital bubble, and there's just a link that you're supposed to click on. You're not seeing that as that person with hurt feelings or who's just sitting there wondering how much food to buy or how much they're going to waste. And so this sounds really stupid, and this is not based in a study, but I would put in a little picture of your face, like just a little social media one, not that's all, you know, whatever it is, that what's that kissy face thing, the duck face
duck
thing,
face, yeah.
Not a duck face selfie, but just say, you know, I need your response, and actually have them respond to your email, because I know people like those groovy invitations, you know, that you can click on the internet. People hate to click on links. I know this is a blogger. It's really terrible. I mean, like, what does it take? 1 second? You know, first world problem. But just have them respond to your email. You're more likely to get a response. And I do like this thing of, like, I need to know how much food to buy and everything. But you still may not get one. It's just really terrible.
Well, Amy, so much to chew on there and maybe change. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I love the topic. Thanks for having me.
That was Amy Alkan. She's a Science Help author, speaker, and podcaster. She's the author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. She joined us to talk about the new rules of etiquette for a digital age.
So lessons learned here. We're going to respond to each other's texts immediately from now on, no matter the time of day.
Absolutely.
Is that the right takeaway?
And more exclamation points.
More exclamation.
Yeah.
I may just
Especially
text you
on your
an
part.
Exclamation point.
This is Central Time.
Tonight will be the deciding game in the World Series after the Chicago Cubs tied it up with Cleveland last night, 3-3.
Both teams have had a long World Series drought. There's been a lot of talk about that. But what about Wisconsin's home team? What about the Milwaukee Brewers and their World Series history?
Long story short, there's not a very long story. The Brewers have made it to the World Series exactly once.
And I remember this. 1982 was the year they were World Series contenders, and they lost to the St. Louis Cardinals in seven games.
So it went the full distance, just like this year's World Series. And we're thinking back here to names like Robin Yount, Cecil Cooper, Paul Molitor, and Raleigh Fingers.
Raleigh Fingers, I loved
of the mustache.
Him.
Yeah.
And my great aunt Edmure went to one of those World Series games, and I remember being really excited. She brought me back one of the foam hands with the number one.
Do you still have that?
No, I think it disintegrated.
Yeah, they'll do that, I think. I've got for my last Brewers game the Bob Uecker bobblehead. It would have been great to hear him make some World Series home run calls.
But I have to say, I am rooting for the Cubs because
the longer drought.
They're in the Midwestern.
The closer.
Yeah, they're in the Midwestern area. They're just they're like the Brewers are kind of the underdogs, and it'll be cool if they win tonight.
All right, well, we'll see. I don't have strong feelings. Best of luck to everybody. Our neighbors in Chicago, what the heck, I'll go with them. Go Cubs. I'm making the call right now here on Central Time.